Oh, the shame up or care if you've let all the fans down.
Can we not lock this?
It's a fact. I am not playing mind games. I am talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladicio, they'd probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions on anything. Religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you, except for those two, have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
All right, welcome along to Team 33. I'm Raf Giallo. You can get in touch with us on Twitter at Team 33. That's all in words. We're also on Facebook and also on iTunes. A slightly different show this week. Last Thursday, we recorded an interview with Ireland and Everton legend Kevin Sheedy. So we were just chatting to him about his career in general, mostly on Everton and Ireland as well. So Conor Neville and Killian Woods dropped in to join me for that one. And we started off by asking him about his kind of unique route into Everton by joining from Liverpool.
Yeah, it was. I signed for Liverpool 4 years earlier. Watched Liverpool win the European Cup. Kenny Dalglish scored the winning goal against Bruges, and then 2 weeks later, I get a phone call from my Hereford chairman to go and sign for Liverpool. So I was there for 4 years. When my contract expired, Everton wanted to sign me, so it was an easy move for me. I'd watched Everton the last couple of years on my contract and knew that the side Howard Kendall was trying to build. He brought Adrian Heath from Stoke for £750,000, Graeme Sharp, Kevin Ratcliffe make his debut. So I knew the side Howard was putting together, so it was an easy move. But it was quite controversial at the time because I was only the second player. Johnny Morrissey had moved 20 years before that across to Liverpool, so I was the second player in history to move to the local rivals.
You say it's an easy move there, Kevin. I'm not sure. That's a weird phrase. Like, what was easy about it? Was it easy that it was a no-brainer to get that first team football because after those kind of few stale years at Liverpool?
Oh, indeed, yes. Yeah, I made 4 appearances in 4 years at Liverpool, but I should have known when I signed my contract. Bob Paisley was the manager, and I signed a 4-year contract. He got up, shook my hand and said, "Congratulations and good luck, Philip." So I knew the writing was on the wall then. He didn't even know my name. So 4 years later, signing for Everton was a great move for me.
Yeah, and often they say never trust journalists, but wasn't it a Daily Mail journalist who almost spurred the move to Everton?
Well, it was the last game of the season for Liverpool. I was playing for Liverpool reserves against Preston, and I was at my digs in Elsey Road. Ronnie Whelan was in digs with me, and the phone went. I answered it, and it was Colin Wood, who was a journalist for the Daily Mail. He said, "Would you be interested in signing for Everton?" I said, "Of course I would." He said, "Well, put the phone down, and Howard Kendall will speak to you." So I was expecting a crank off, being a prank off one of the players. But I put the phone down. Sure enough, Howard Kendall rang me. He said he was going to come and watch me in the game, and the rest is history.
How much do you have to do to kind of win over the Everton fans? I suppose you lost the Liverpool fans, and they, even if you were a bit part player, I'm sure they look back and they probably boo you anytime you come out in the Anfield pitch. But like, how did you have to do? You have to win over the Everton fans as well.
To be fair, I don't get any stick from the Liverpool supporters at all. They understood my situation, that I wasn't getting in the first team there. My only concern was at that time was the Everton supporters. If they were thinking, well, if he's not good enough for Liverpool, why would he be good enough for Everton? So I knew I had to hit the ground running. I trained really hard at my first pre-season, got into the team, and I started really well. Scored against Tottenham, Goodison, played really well. So I won the supporters over instantly, really. So that I knew that was massively important to do that. So I was prepared for the challenge. It was good.
I wouldn't remember the rivalry between Everton and Liverpool in the 80s so much. Something about the sort of seamlessness of your move seems to suggest the rivalry wasn't quite as vicious. Is that fair to say as it is now? Or were the fans more respectful of each other in those days?
It's changed over the time. I think, you know, in my period, there's certainly cup finals, for instance, you could use an example. You know, a car would be travelling down from Merseyside in a family. There'd be a blue scarf on one side of the car, there'd be a red scarf on the other side. And he's still got the same banter and camaraderie sort of thing, you know. So I think it's getting back to how it was in the 80s. And, you know, both sets of supporters are really passionate. They both want their team to do well. They're both knowledgeable supporters. So, you know, there's obviously going to be intense rivalry, you know, with both sets of supporters.
Yeah, and like you join at a time where Everton are just about to start launching into this great era, probably the greatest in the club's entire history. And the FA Cup is the first thing in 1984. In terms of the building blocks, because Howard Kendall, we did a kind of piece on the Everton 80s team just before Christmas, and it seemed there was a lot of pressure on at the time because results weren't arriving. But could you see the seeds of it kind of coming together?
Yeah, well, obviously, when you're training with great players every day, you know the potential of what the players need. You've got Neville Southall in goal, who at that time when we were doing really well was the best goalkeeper in the world. You had a back four, Gary Stevens, Kevin Ratcliffe, Derek Mountfield, John Bailey, Peter Reid, Paul Bracewell, Trevor Stephen, myself, Graham Sharp, Adrian Heath. So in training, we knew how good we were, but we just weren't quite getting the results. And Howard was under a little bit of pressure, you know, because the results weren't going great. But we stuck at it. We had a couple of important results to turn the corner. And then once we turned the corner, you know, winning the FA Cup is the first major trophy for the players. And then obviously kick-started us into the 85 season.
Yeah, and they often say kind of winning a trophy almost brings a club together, and then also, you know, it can be a launch pad for something else. For you, that 84 Cup win and the way the team did it, I know you missed it through injury, but
yeah.
For the next season, when you go on to win the league, in what way did it kind of manifest itself as a kind of boost?
Well, I think it gives you confidence that you're capable of competing with the best teams. The FA Cup is obviously a shortcut to success, but you've still got to win it. The league, when you win the league, the best team always wins the league. There's no lucky team wins the league. The league is the, you know, you need to perform every week. Certainly 85, we were dominant. The turning point for me was when we played Man United at Goodison. They were touted as the champions elect. We beat them 5-0 on the day. We absolutely, and they were a good team. They had a lot of great players, but we just destroyed them on the day. And I think that was the belief after the game that, you know, we just, you know, destroyed a really good team. And I think that gave us the confidence to kick on from there.
You won the league in 84, 85. I mean, how frustrating was it then not to be able to compete in the European Cup the following year? And does that still annoy you? I mean, you were presumably winding up for the European Cup or assuming you were going to be in it the following year. Was it a big setback not to be able to compete in it the following year?
Well, I think if you look back at the 85 season, winning the league, we won the Cup Winners' Cup. We beat Bayern Munich in the semi-final over a two-leg. Bayern Munich went on to win the Bundesliga the next year. They were a top team in Europe. We beat Rapid Vienna in the final. 3 days later, we got beat 1-0 by Man United in the FA Cup final. So we come really close to doing a treble. And obviously, the Heysel disaster, it gave FIFA the opportunity to sort of ban British clubs from Europe because British clubs were dominant in those days. Yeah. So really, I think out of, you know, Everton suffered the most because of the team that we had. We felt we were capable of winning the European Cup. And we didn't get the opportunity to compete in it. Which was, looking back, which was obviously from a professional point of view disappointing, but obviously it was a tragedy. And you know, football, you know, it's to take second place.
Yeah, and often, like back in those days, obviously squads were a little bit smaller. Was it actually a massive challenge then to kind of be competing and going on to win the league, and also competing in Europe, and then going on to win that just across the kind of course of that campaign in 85?
Yeah, I think it just shows. I mean, 85, we used mostly the same players. As you said, there wasn't big squads. You played with injuries. You played every game. If you were fit and you were playing well, you played. So you didn't look to sort of... There was no rotation system in those days. If you were fit, you were selected. Your training was, toned down to help you with the games, but you just wanted to play because the atmospheres at Goodison Park particularly, you didn't want to miss out on any of those magical moments.
One magical moment you did miss out on actually were the celebrations after you beat Rapid Vienna in the final. Was it right yourself and Gary Stevens were kind of sent off to do kind of a random drug test and obviously kind of missed the entire post-match celebrations?
Yeah, that was the I mean, obviously, the high of winning a major European trophy, going around, you know, with the teammates that you've worked all season, you know, you've sweated through, and you finally got a European trophy. And as you say, Gary Season himself got ushered into a room to do a sample. And as athletes know, you can't do it straight away. So it took us between 45 minutes and an hour to be able to do a sample. We went back to our dressing room, ready to celebrate with all our teammates. And it was only Gary and myself tracksuit there. The other players had finished the celebrations, showered, and were on the bus. So I look back, I missed out on an opportunity to celebrate with my teammates.
Yeah, and looking back at some footage of some of your goals at the time, set pieces and obviously free kicks are one of your specialties. I want to take you back to one against Ipswich, if you might remember it now. It's one that was actually retaken, but the funny thing is, the first attempt, top left corner, second attempt, an even better finish in the other one.
That's it, yeah. Well, I used to practice because when you've got 40,000 Evertonians chanting your name when you get a free kick, you'd better be able to deliver. So I used to practice all the time. The one you're talking about was against Ipswich, the quarter final of the FA Cup. We were getting beat 1-0. It was about 20, 22 yards out. And I used to try and get on the ball early and just try and gain an advantage. So Ipswich wall wasn't correctly put together. So I took it quickly, as you say, bent it into Paul Cooper's left-hand corner. The referee disallowed it, put the ball down, and he'd sort of, Paul Cooper had edged over to the side where I just put the ball in the net, knowing I could do that, and he left a nice gap on the other side, so I managed to put it over the ball to his other side. And it's one of most Evertonians of that era, when I meet them, that's the goal they love talking about, you know, they were at the ground and, you know, just talking about it.
Kevin, is all that detail there, do you remember that, or is that something because you've looked it back? Like, I know even when I play at a very low level five-a-side, when I don't remember anything I do on the pitch. Do you remember those sort of things? Like, do they stick in your mind?
It's crazy because, I mean, my wife goes mad for my children's birthdays. I'm hopeless with dates. I'm hopeless with names and things like that. But I can remember most of my goals. So I don't know what's, but no, certainly that one, when you look back into when your career's over, that's one of the highlights of my career.
Which is the one that sticks in your mind the most?
It has to be the goal against England in the World Cup. I've got many great memories at Everton, but as a young boy when you're growing up and you're looking at Brazil playing in the World Cup, that's your ultimate aim is to get them playing in a World Cup. So obviously when we qualified in 90, getting Ireland's first ever goal in the World Cup is a piece of history nobody will ever be able to take away from me. That's right at the very, very top.
Yeah, and speaking of your Ireland career, actually, you started in 1984, and this is 4 years before the when we first qualified for Euro 88. And I suppose it's almost forgotten because we always think about the kind of Jack Charlton era and the success that came there. What was the team like in that period before he just came in?
I was playing for the youth team when I was under 16, under 17. So I played right the way through the Ireland setup, and obviously in the Owen Hands era. And we had some good players, but we didn't have the chemistry that Jack put together with our team qualifying for the 88 championships. You can have good players, but you've got to get the best out of them. And I felt Jack, you know, did it perfectly.
Yeah, and the debut is very memorable for you as well because it's Malta, an 8-0 win. It is the biggest win Ireland have ever achieved at any point in kind of football history. And you score as well.
Yeah, great memories. I mean, we were confident of beating anybody, both home and away. So Malta was, we played them quite a few times, and as you said, the 8-0 was a real good performance.
Yeah, and getting into Euro 88 as well, like you play in every single game as well. In terms of 1990 then, it obviously must have been kind of a boost, and we're maybe seeing that with the Iceland team that were actually over in Ireland there recently, that it actually does boost you into the next qualifying campaign.
Indeed, I mean, there was a lot of qualifying games to get to Germany in 88, and I think it gave us confidence to qualify and get there. We played some real top teams. Obviously, England, Ray Houghton scored the first against, you know, with the winner against England. We play Russia, who were a top team, and then we play Holland, and we were 6 minutes away from knocking Holland out. If we drew against them in the third game, we'd have qualified. Holland were the best team in it. They won it eventually, but we came that close, and I think that gave us the confidence that we could compete against anybody in the world. And then obviously going on to the qualifying games in the World Cup leading up to Italy, you know, we were capable of beating anybody.
In Italia 90 proper, had the players or people around the camp any sense of the mood at home? Because it was a very seminal event, I suppose, in Irish life, really, you know, Italia 90, you know, it had a huge impact. Was there any sense of the around the camp that of the mood and the party that was going on back in Ireland? I know communication wasn't as easy back then, but did that break through to you while it was happening?
I think it did after about the second game, where you obviously played England and then we played Egypt, and then we were getting the reporters were getting this footage of obviously what was happening back in Ireland and the parties, and so it really sort of like not shook us, but just we then grasped as to what was actually going on. You know, everyone on, you know, when the games were on, everybody was just watching the games and all that. You know, the country came to a standstill. But I think my biggest memory, if anybody asks me, you know, what do you remember about 1990, when we came back to the homecoming around Dublin and going down O'Connell Street, and I remember getting to the end of it and looking back, and there was no phones in those days, and, you know, I'd love to have a picture. There was about 250,000 people down on O'Connell Street, and it was the best memory that I've ever had, you know, seeing the, you know, how we'd affected, you know, that many people.
Yeah, and even on you kind of touched on the England or the goal against England, I suppose looking back at it again, and there's that little moment where it kind of bubbles back to you, and then there's that presence of mind. Can you kind of just take us through, like, I suppose, a frame by frame account of it?
Yeah, well, it's something that goes back to my childhood, where I used to practice kicking a ball against a wall. I lived in the country. I was born up in a pub, and that's all I did all day, was just kicking a ball against the wall. It was like three different types of walls. We had a gents' toilet wall that was like the size of a goal. I'd practice my finishing there. There would be a bigger ball. I'd practice my passing. So I was self-taught, and then you obviously go through your career in training. You practice your finishing. So going on to the goal, I tried to play a pass to Tony Cascarino. Steve McMahon intercepted it. Steve had only just come on as a substitute, so he wasn't up to the pace of the game. He tried to play a square pass to Gary Stevens, which I intercepted. I took a first touch and just hit it instantly. And it's a great feeling, because I knew as soon as I hit it, it was in the bottom corner. Because over the years, you'd practice and practice. Peter Shilton sort of vainly tried to save it, but it was in the back of the net before he died. So it was just a great, great emotion. I don't know how I would have celebrated. Steve Staunton grabbed me before I could do anything, so I don't really know how I would have celebrated, but it was just, you know, a fantastic personal moment, and, you know, so many people in Ireland, you know, love recalling that goal.
Yeah, it's definitely. I mean, you hit the net twice in the Italia 90 campaign. Most, when it comes to the Romania penalty shootout, most people remember, I suppose, the David O'Leary penalty, but also Tony Cascarino, because he nearly made a balls of it.
Could I just go back to that goal? Sorry, realise how you affect people.
Yeah.
I was over at Punching Star Races last year, and I was in a hotel, and a couple approached me, and he said, Kevin Sheedy? He said, yeah. He said, this is my wife. We're celebrating 25 years of marriage. And he said, we lived in the same village, but never went to the same venues. And the night of the Ireland-England game, they were at the same place. When I scored, they were next to each other, jumped up, hugged each other, gave each other a kiss, and started going out. So they were celebrating 25 years. So I said, you've got a lot to thank me for.
Oh, they certainly do.
Were you invited to do
it? You don't realise, you know, how you affect different people.
Were you invited to any anniversary parties or anything?
Yes, he did, actually. We had a good night. We stayed with the company, so had a real good night. But going on to what you said before about Dave O'Leary's goal.
Well, I was wondering about the penalty shootout. How did you decide who was going to take them? I mean, was there practice going on? Was it just a case of someone, you know, because penalties, Ireland had never been in a penalty shootout before. Were they practiced, or did you just decide it on the basis of who was most up for it? You know,
well, a bit of both. I mean, I was the main penalty taker, so I was always going to take the first one because my look thinking on it was there's no point staying taking the last one. We might not even, you know, might not get that far. So once the final whistle went, I just said, I'll take the first one. So I just got myself off in my own zone, just focused on what I was going to do. I always used to strike it really firm. The first penalty, I decided their goalkeeper's got to dive, so I was going to keep it high, keep it down the middle, and hit it as hard as I could. So which I did. You know, it was a long walk from the halfway line up to the penalty. There was all the Irish supporters were behind that goal as well, which was a little bit more pressure. So the whistle went, and you know, kept me focus, and struck it as well as I could have done, right down the middle, and it thankfully hit the back of the net.
But yeah, and actually just on that, actually, because goalkeepers, I think you've made that point before, they tend to dive on the first one, either left or right. So there was almost that logic, down the middle, you're pretty much safe.
Well, you're not always safe, because if you stand there, you look a bit of a fool sort of thing. But yeah. I think the goalkeepers, they've got to sort of make an effort to go one side or the other. So, you know, I'd sort of taken penalties for Everton. I'd taken a couple for Ireland. So you have to be in that situation to hold your nerve. So I remember going back to when you said about, you know, who's going to take them. Andy Townsend offered, Ray Houghton offered to take one. And then we were running out of people who were, you know, they were all stepping backwards as rather stepping forwards. And then he said, Cass, you take one. And he didn't really want to take one, but fair play to him. He said, okay, I will. And then Dave said, well, but no one else, I'll take the fifth one. So it was, you know, sometimes, you know, players step forward or some don't fancy to take them. But I think Andy Townsend scored, Ray scored, and then Cass went up to take it. And if you look at the penalty, it's the worst penalty. He took the biggest divot, and I think the goalkeeper dived early, and it just trickled in. So that's a bit of luck you need. And obviously, Packie made a great save, and then Dave steps into the arena to win the penalty shootout for us, and he kept his nerve. Great penalty, you know. So brilliant moment.
Is it true that you gave him a little bit of advice in terms of which way to go, even or even the approach to it?
Yeah, I did, because I'd missed a couple of penalties for Everton, and I'd missed or had one saved by Neville Southall against Wales, but someone knocked in the rebound, so I didn't actually miss it. So that was always my thought process, was pick your spot, don't change your mind. And I just said that to Dave. I said, Dave, just pick your spot, hit it as clean as you can, and that was it. And he did, and it was, as I say, it was a fantastic moment.
Yeah, Kevin, such an interesting contrast. What we had Mark Hinsell on the show a few weeks ago, and he was talking about taking a penalty in the playoff final, and how he followed that logic, which was, you know, pick your spot, don't change. And I think he said he changed his mind about 100 times in the walk up to, and he doesn't even remember feeling his legs, I think, walking up to the penalty spot. How do you keep in that frame of mind? Like, is it just you have to? That's the advice you give. But how do you not change your mind? It must be so many things flying through your head.
I think it's experience. I think if you look, you're looking at England over the years, you know, the amount of penalty shootouts they've lost, and you're looking at players who've missed the major penalties. They're not goal scorers. They've never scored a goal, most of them in their careers, and then they're asked to take a penalty to stay in a major competition. Whereas some of the other players that are goal scorers, they haven't offered to take them, so they bottle it a little bit. So you can never recreate that situation of stepping up to take a major penalty. You know, so there's different sorts of penalties. It's a penalty like Dave had to win it. If he'd have missed it, we were still in the competition. And then if you've got a penalty where if you miss, you're out. So this is added pressure on different sorts of penalties.
Yeah, and then the Italy game, I suppose we forget less. I suppose we don't remember as much, because we always think about the Romania one, and even some of the commentary moments from it. But you found yourself kind of man-marked by Beppe Bergomi, which I suppose is a compliment in itself.
It is. It was. Someone showed me something not so long ago, and he was only about 27, and he had like 60 caps, and someone like Baresi had about 25 caps. He got into the Italy side as a real young player, and to play for Italy that length of time, that many caps for a young player, just shows what a great player he was. And he certainly was my most difficult opponent. As you say, he man-marked me, got really tight. I found it difficult to elude him, sort of thing. The game itself was really close encounter. The referee gave every 50-50 decision to Italy, being the home team. Sometimes that tips the scale. And then obviously the goal that they scored to win it was forced to Scalacci, who was absolutely on fire. He was the top goal scorer. And we ran them close. We had a couple of half chances. Niall Quinney had a header. And we came really close. And Jack said after the game, you won't realize how close you've come to get into a World Cup final, because if you'd have got through it against Argentina, who were an aging team, they still had Maradona, but they were an aging team, and they got through to the final. West Germany beat them 1-0. So it was we got to the quarterfinals, which is great, but a little bit of a fortune, we could have gone a bit further.
Yeah, and of course, this kind of that parallel is at around the same time as the Everton team is starting to kind of, I suppose, fall apart a little bit in comparison to the highs you'd experienced in 85 and 87. A few new signings had kind of come in and things like that. And then Kendall had obviously gone to Athletic Bilbao. For you, what was it? Clearly, just a case of kind of Kendall leaving, and then that's kind of where the seams kind of come apart a little bit.
I think going back to Heysel really was probably the start of it, where the team started to break up. Howard left to go to Bilbao, as you said, and then Colin Harvey took over as manager, and he was replacing the likes of Trevor Stephen with Pat Nevin, Gary Stevens with Neil McDonald, who were good players, but they weren't the top players that Gary and Trevor were. So I think the side was starting to get changed, and the quality that was leaving, the quality wasn't as good that was getting brought in, and that's when we went on a bit of a not as competing at the top level as we should have been.
There's a sense now that Howard Kendall doesn't have the standing nowadays that he should have, given what he achieved with Everton in the 80s. I mean, what were his main qualities as a manager? What stood out about him?
Oh, I think he's got the utmost respect from all Evertonians and football people. He was a great man. He left us far, far too early. But he was, first and foremost, one of Everton's best ever players. And he's Everton's most ever successful manager. And you don't get any of those. He's left a real impact at Everton. He was a great man. He was so knowledgeable about football. He wasn't a ranter and raver. But his biggest skill to me was his man management skill. He could get the very best out of everybody. He knew how to people needed different ways of being treated. He certainly got the best out of me. I've got everything to thank him for. He made me the player that I was. I loved playing for him. I loved going in training. And he liked the social side with the players. He made sure they all enjoyed themselves. And we had a great team spirit, which we took onto the pitch. And it was similar with Ireland. The same thing under Jack. We had a great team spirit. We socialised at the right time. And we were certainly a team when we were on the pitch.
Yeah, one of the things, wasn't it Kendall who kind of brought in a sense of team bonding as well, kind of going off to, I suppose, either restaurants or maybe the pub or whatever as well, and it's a good way to kind of let off steam and bring the lads together?
I think he just liked the squad being together. So socialising at the right times. It was always at the right times. And we enjoyed ourselves. We trained hard. And he was big on team spirits, teams he'd played with. He'd won the First Division Championship, the league with Everton, with Ball, Harvey Kendall, the Holy Trinity, and they all had a great team spirit. So he just put into practice what he did as a player.
Yeah, and I think banter flies in some of this kind of stuff as well. And I think you mentioned this in your book. Martin Keown, I think, took exception one time to one of your jokes.
Yeah, indeed. I think it's probably best if people buy my book. So Good I Did It Twice. It's chapter 7, and they'll get the real ins of what actually happened.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we've heard the story anyway, so yes, we know how it culminated.
Yes,
and obviously Everton's a real family club as well. You've been coaching there for years as well. In terms of the that sense of being able to bring players back as well, it's pretty unique in a way.
It is. I've been coaching the under-18s for 10 years now, so I've seen the likes of Ross Barkley, Tom Davis of late come through. We've got a great academy, we've got a great system, and we produce footballers, just keep playing, producing footballers for our first team, but also for championship teams, first division teams. So we've got a great record of getting players through. We've got ex-Everton players on the coaching staff, because it's really important to instill into the young players what it means to be an Everton player, what goes with it, the expectations of the supporters when you're playing at Goodison home and away. I'm really enjoy doing that.
Kevin, we've really enjoyed this chat. Thanks a million for taking the time to chat to us.
My pleasure.
All right, that's the interview with Ireland and Everton legend Kevin Sheedy. And you'll find the podcast in full on iTunes and newstalk.com. And that's it for this week's show. We're going to be back next Tuesday. Take it away, Johan.